How do I know what I think until I see what I say?
The Green Notebook, carried by military leaders around the world. Within those pages are sweat, tears, triumphs, and the hard-won lessons of life. Lessons worth sharing. Each week, the team dives into the notebooks of military leaders, business professionals, authors, athletes and coaches, and entertainers to share lessons and help you lead with the best version of yourself.
Hey, it's Joe here, and every morning before I crack open a book or sit down to do some writing, the first thing I do is brew an amazing cup of Alpha Coffee. They make premium 100% Arabica coffee, and Alpha has some of my favorite blends. They have Dawn Patrol, which is a nice medium light breakfast blend. I also enjoy Charlie Don't Surf, which is a medium Kona blend. And I even get to take Alpha Coffee to work with me because they also make K-Cups. Not only do they have great coffee, they're a great veteran-owned business who has shipped over 20,000 bags of coffee to deployed troops. They also offer a 10% discount to members of the military and first responders. And Alpha Coffee has been an awesome company to partner with at From the Green Notebook. So taste the Alpha difference and purchase their coffee today at www.alpha.coffee or via Amazon Prime. Welcome to another episode of From the Green Notebook. I'm your host, Joe Byerly. And this week, we're diving into the notebook of Joe McCormick. In our last episode together back in 2020, Joe and I talked about his debut book, Brief, Make a Bigger Impact by Saying Less. As many of you know, I call Brief my communications Bible. I credit that book with helping me become a much better communicator in both my personal and professional life. In this episode, we discuss Joe's follow-up book, Noise, Living and Leading When Nobody Can Focus. And we talk about the problem of infobesity and how it can keep you and I from leading with the best version of ourselves. And Joe shares ways we can create quiet at the workplace and our homes so that we can give ourselves a space to actually think, which is a prerequisite to effective communications. So grab your notebooks and please welcome to the show, Joe McCormick.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for coming back, Joe. Last time we talked, about your book, Brief. I believe that was like my third or fourth episode of a podcast that you're the one who kicked me in the butt and told me to start recording podcast. And then now we're back talking about your second book, the follow-up to that, Noise, Living and Leading When Nobody Can Focus.
It's really great to talk to you again. I'm happy that I kicked you in the butt because your podcast is awesome and you've got a lot of great guests and I'm humbled to be one of them. The book Noise was an important book for me to write. It was the environment that we live in. There's so many things that are competing for our attention. I teach with Brief how to be a lean communicator, and the clutter is the noise. We need to cut through the clutter, but everybody's brains are saturated with so many things, competing interests and distractions and disruptions, that environment needs a strategy or a way to first recognize it, that it's so, that it's nobody's direct fault that they created it. And you got to figure out a way to manage it, because if it's not managing you, you know, you're managing it or it's managing you. So that was the driving force behind me writing it.
Let's talk about that. One of the concepts that you wrote about in the book was something that I love, and it's kind of stuck with me, the concept of infobesity.
Yeah, that term was coined by a woman named Sam Horn, who I met years ago, and she helped me with Brief, actually. And she's great with coming up with terms, but you think about, like, people feed on information, and a lot of that information are just empty calories. And my analogy to that is, like, if you've got a diet of information and you keep on, it's like having a diet of popcorn and Diet Coke, you know, so you're all day long, you're feeling full, but you really are anemic. And that is how people treat their role in the world, is sort of consuming information is what it means to be human, or what I do all day. And that makes people sort of overwhelmed, burdened, infobese would be another way. It at times could be almost tragic.
Yeah, I wrote, like, that idea just generated a series of essays I wrote a couple of years ago. And I came across this stat that was actually, it's kind of sick when you look at it. The average person spends anywhere from 3 to 5 hours a day on their smartphones. And that's like the average. Those living on the high end of the spectrum spend 6.2 days a month or 75 days a year glued to their screens. And so if you think about it, and you're talking about diet, you know, that would be like eating cheeseburgers for every meal for 75 days a year. And we would never do that for our health. Yet, like, we so easily do it every day with our phones.
Well, that's the movie Supersize Me.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, that whole thing was just sort of like, what would that experiment look like, for as sick as it might sound? Like, I actually made a movie on it. And it sort of becomes the way people live their lives. And I think people don't even realize that it's happening. So the picture that I kind of, in my mind, when I look at this is, you know, imagine you're in an airport and you just stop. And if you could freeze everybody around you and you did a 360, what are they all doing? And they're all on their phones. Like, that's what defines what you do with your time, is to consume information and communicate. And that's just the state of affairs. So I'm not like an anti-tech guy, because I've been an early adopter, but it does kind of beg the question, where does it end? How does it end? How is it managed? You know, if it is like Kenny Chesney's song, Noise, right? We didn't turn it off, but we can't turn it off. And the lyrics of that song are pretty telling. It's like, we didn't turn it on, but we can't turn it off. So it wasn't my fault that it started, but now I'm sort of like beholden to it. And in this whole thing of like noise management or information obesity becomes a huge issue that people need to think about.
Yeah, I think before I read Noise, one of the things that I used to do is I would find myself doom scrolling like my Twitter feed. It was like I needed to stay up on the news 24/7. And I read it, and I read Noise, and I started thinking about it. And majority of the stuff that's out there has zero effect on me. And I can't affect it, right? And so, like, why am I spending all this time consuming all this stuff? And then I came across another quote by Nassim Taleb, the guy that wrote the book about black swans. And he said, if the information is important enough, it's going to find its way to my ears. And so, you know, kind of piecing that together with Noise, I cut back on it almost completely. I could check the news maybe once a day, maybe once every other day or something, just to kind of see what's going on in the world. But that being said, I still struggle with it. If I see a notification on my phone, Joe, I will pick it up just to check the notification. And then sometimes I'll look up and it's like 45 minutes later.
What you're describing is something which is interesting, is that many people experience exactly the same thing, but they've never really stopped and looked back. Okay, what's actually happening? During the pandemic, we gave out guidance about like what to do with information. And a colleague of mine came up with this distinction, which is really, it was simple, but super powerful. It was the distinction between being well-informed and sufficiently informed. So you kind of go back into this mode where like everybody is like seriously like watching the news to find out what's going to happen, what is happening. And we all want to be well-informed. Nobody wakes up and goes, I don't want to be well-informed. The problem is defining what well-informed means that you continue to read 7 stories about the same thing 7 times. Like I read the same story in all the news, sir. And it's, I'm reading, we locally here, we just had a blackout in Moore County, and I was trying to find out what was going on. I was trying to be well-informed. I read a whole bunch of stories that said exactly the same thing. So his distinction was, well, your job is to be sufficiently informed enough. When you look at information, there's no limit to it. You can consume as much as you want. It's like eating. You can eat all day long. I want to be well-fed, overfed. This is like the distinction. So this, be sufficiently informed. Don't try to be well-informed, because you'll overconsume.
And I think the one thing that we don't think about is kind of like what we focus on determines how we experience life. And, you know, I'll just keep nerding out with you, Joe, and just keep throwing out book quotes. But the guy that coined the term flow, that state that you get in where you lose track of time and you're performing at your highest level, he was a famous researcher, Dr. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, and he found that the information we allow into our consciousness becomes extremely important. It is, in fact, what determines the content and quality of our life. And so if you're constantly like just getting sucked into these stories that are actually written to keep us consuming the stories, you know, a lot of these breaking news that's not really breaking news, all of a sudden your life becomes this like crazy post-apocalyptic world because everything is burning around you.
Well, the thing about it is if you look at your attention as the most precious asset you have, is where what you consume and what you pay attention to is entirely a person's decision. What goes in my mind is my responsibility. It's nobody else's responsibility. Well, people are not aware of where they're paying attention and how much attention is wasted. So the term that I've heard and I use is return on attention. If I'm exerting this much attention on something which is meaningless, I'm wasting it. And what ends up happening is if you look at news, it starts to trigger, and it's wired this way to get me into a place that I can't stop doing it. Well, I have to be responsible for that. And one of the things that I recommend to people, say no. I mean, there's a moment where it's mature, responsible to say no. And it's irresponsible to keep on saying yes, because at some point you give up your choice. I'm not actually making a free choice anymore. It's becoming like almost Pavlovian and instinctive to like grab my phone because I'm bored, or to stay on my phone and go down a rabbit hole of like check. So return on attention is like, am I getting the best return on my attention? And the answer for a lot of people is they're not.
As I've gotten older, Joe, and as I look back, you know, in the last like decade or so, I've wasted so much time on social media, on, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, even LinkedIn, just sitting there scrolling, reading about other. And it's funny too, it's kind of ironic, is that I'm not living my life, but I'm watching other people live theirs through curated pictures. And
it just messes with your head. I mean, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Technology is good. Social media is great. There's a lot of really wonderful things about it. But what ends up happening to people is they just use, it's the amount of time and energy that's exerted on something which gives very little return. And, you know, I've heard it compared to like alcohol. Is that relationship giving me the best benefit in return? Well, a lot of people can say if they drink too much, like that's not a good, there's not a good return there. And the same thing with where my attention gets spent. Like I spend a lot of time, people would say, and the question is are you getting something back from it? And with some of the stuff is the answer is very, very immediately, not really. And the truth is I can live without it. And I call this like, it's noise and you got to treat it as noise. And the best thing to do is hit mute. So if you could imagine this, like if I had a tool that could make the world just mute it, just hit a mute button. And that mute button comes from me saying no, or no, not now. And then I start mitigating it and managing it and corralling it to the point where I can manage it a bit. Right now, it's not manageable for most people.
Yeah, it reminds me, I've gotten very deliberate over the last couple of years of how I spend my time. But before that, I don't know if you remember a game that used to be really popular, Guitar Hero.
Yeah.
And like, I would spend hours pressing buttons, like different colored buttons, trying to master the songs on Xbox. And then one day it hit me, all the time that I was investing in just pressing colored buttons, I could have actually learned how to play the guitar. And then that would have been a better return on investment than just pressing buttons. And so like, you know, now I try to be a lot more deliberate about what I'm consuming, which is, you know, there's a bunch of books behind me that you were commenting on right before we got started. That reflection writing, and I actually have a good ROI, you know, to your point on that. I have a body of work that I can show for it.
Yeah, you could never, like, if you read a good book, this is nothing against playing a video game or anything, but I think it was Blaise Pascal talked about diversions and that we all, our lives are just trying to find things to just distract and divert our attention from the things that really matter the most. Is in a world of information, we live in an information age, a lot of it is useless. It's not useless to everybody, but for most people, the stuff they consume, a lot of it's useless. The first thing I think people need to know is how much attention am I spending on stuff that doesn't matter? At the end of the day, it just doesn't matter that much. And where am I, like reading is something you talk about a lot, the value of reading and the lost art of reading. The people, when you start to lose your attention span, people can't sit down and read a book anymore. And there's actually books about the loss of readership. And that becomes a threat to civilization and culture, that people don't read anymore because they can't. and they don't have time for it. Well, back in the day, all the books behind you, people would read. Well, what's happening is they're starving themselves. They're filled with useless information, and they're lacking in stuff that has nutrients, which are good history and novels and stuff that matters. And they swap it out, and not to be a purist, but that becomes like threatening to civilization and culture and the political landscape and in organizations. Like my employees, business leaders might think, are they reading things that help them be, you know, sharpen their craft and be better at work, or they're just like, you know, wasting their way in Margaritaville, so to speak. And like, and that as a person, you start to wonder, like, is this noise kind of overwhelming people to the point of submission?
You mentioned attention spans in your research. Have you found that noise has actually affected that?
What it does is when you consume information unwillingly, just sort of like instinctively, like notifications come and you're not even saying yes, but you've already sort of given it. What that means is like moment to moment, your attention's divided, it's depleted. That's what a deficit of it. When your brain has something called working memory, which is the easiest way it's described to me is the amount of digits you can hold in the present moment. So think of a phone number, right? 10-digit phone number, right? You're overseas where you've got longer phone numbers and nobody knows exactly how they work. Even the people in the country
either.
Doesn't.
I don't either.
You still don't know. In Mexico City, I had some time, spent some time, you know, it's like they have no rhyme or reason to how the phone system works. But if you had to remember a very long series of digits, you can't anymore because your working memory is so divided and depleted that you're trying to focus on 10 things at the same time. You can't focus on one thing for a sustained amount of time. That's the product of constantly consuming information and multitasking from thing to thing.
As you're talking about this too, like one of the things that I'm really into is performance, increasing performance. And, there's a great book by Cal Newport, which I feel like is a companion to your book called Deep Work. And he talks about the difference between diffused and focused attention. And he says that focused attention is what's required for that 10,000 hours of deliberate practice to be good at something, because it strengthens the myelin in the brain, which then like focuses on those neurons that are able to focus on that task at hand. But when you have that diffused attention, you're all over the place and you're not really getting better at anything. And we are like, it's just, we're kind of mindlessly letting this stuff happen to us.
The different ways that I've categorized attention in doing research for the book Noise was sort of think of three categories of attention. One is directed attention. I'm having a conversation with you and I'm focusing my attention entirely on you. I have moments for undirected attention. I go for a walk and I'm not thinking about anything. And there's actually a lot of research that says that's good attention because I let my mind wander in a good way. Creativity and innovation comes from that. That's why people have good ideas in showers. They take a shower because they're not thinking about water pressure or anything. They're just taking a shower. And then you have something called misdirected attention, which is imagine right now in this conversation, I've started checking my phone or the stock market or the traffic outside the building. So at times I need to really focus. I need to direct my attention. Sometimes I need to say no when my directing gets misdirected. My attention gets misdirected. And sometimes I need to let it have time to be undirected. Because you can't focus all the time because it takes a lot of energy to focus. What's happening right now is there's general mismanagement of attention. In noise, technology sort of dictates when I consume and how much I consume and how often I consume. And somehow people don't feel like they have a say in the matter. And they do. It's our responsibility to manage it, because my line is, if you're not managing noise, noise is managing you. And that's what Newport's getting at. You cannot do deep work if you let that happen.
If somebody's listening to this right now and they're like, oh man, you know, I'm essentially playing Guitar Hero on my phone all the time, or you know, like I'm stuck in Instagram, I'm stuck in Twitter. Like, what's the first step to getting a handle on noise?
The first step is that you have a say, and it's your personal responsibility to manage it. It's nobody else's other than yours. You cannot delegate that to somebody else. Social media is not responsible for what you consume because of an algorithm, right? So the first thing is you got to recognize that it's my responsibility what I think about and what I don't think about. Second thing, just from a strategy, is there's a very, very simple and short word. It's actually in the word noise, and it's the word no. It's okay to say no. If a notification comes, I say no to it. And my experience in writing the book Noise was, at the beginning of writing that book, I worked for my smartphone. Now my smartphone works for me. I tell it when it helps me and I tell it when it doesn't, because I say no to it. And no seems very permanent. Here's a better way of looking at no, not now.
Right.
Email, I don't look at email all day long. Some people do. That's a lot of times noise. We're at the middle of the dinner table. My thing is just saying no. Like, one of the things about technology is, without getting like down a whole other rabbit hole, in my opinion, I'm going to be pretty emphatic about it. Smartphones should not be allowed in bedrooms, specifically in bed. If you're a person that has a phone in bed in any way, shape, or form, stop doing that. It's not good at all. It affects sleep, relation. I mean, it affects a lot of things. So, and the third thing is quiet. So first is you have a voice, you have a say. Second is you can say no. And third is the value of quiet, because quiet is defined as the absence of noise. You start pushing it out through quiet.
Do you have tips for those that, you know, you're like, Joe, yeah, but I have to have my phone on me all the time?
And yeah, I mean, the thing about it is what people need to do is they need to define what is an emergency for me. What happens is people category like, well, something like bad might happen. Okay, well, there are ways to rig technology to get alerts from people like that. So I am not a 911 operator, and most people aren't either. But they act with their phone like they are, right? The president's not calling most of these people on the phone saying you need to answer right away, but they treat their phone like it's sort of rigged, like it's like Die Hard and Bruce Willis going to call, say, I need help at the Yakima, whatever it's called. No, that's not most people's reality. Yeah, there are a few people, and there's ways to set your phones to do those things. I generally, what I do is I have like on hours and off hours. So I'm on 9 to 5, 7 to 7, and I don't look at my phone before 7 a.m. and I don't generally look at it after like 8 p.m. It's not hard and fast, but companies are open 9 to 5. People should have the same relationship with technology. Like, technology doesn't need to be 24/7. You don't need it 3 o'clock in the morning. Most people don't, but they act like they do. They really don't. Go back and review that behavior for the last month and find out how many emergencies really happened.
Yeah.
Very few.
I want to say, like, I was listening to a podcast one day, and they said that, like, it was like a full 24 hours after the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima before the president made an announcement about what happened. And, like, today, we would expect something, like, right now.
There's a couple things to that. I mean, one is that's how the world was and can still be. But it was like that because we didn't have the technology to sort of, it wasn't always on connectivity. I had this insight. I was on vacation we were in Mexico, actually, at the time. This is a number of years ago. And it was when Wi-Fi started becoming a thing, but it wasn't like a full thing yet. So you would go to resorts and timeshares and condos and stuff that didn't have internet access, or your phone just didn't work. So we were in one of those places, like, your phone didn't work. Now it always works. And I thought to myself, this is what I thought. I'm like, if something really, really, really bad happened in the world, my only conduit to the entire world was the cleaning lady. Like, the lady that took the bucket up the stairs to like to clean the townhouse, so the owner put up in the apartment. Like, if something bad happened in the world, I had no newspaper, no internet, no radio. I was completely blacked out. If something really bad happened, like you said earlier, it would find you. It would have come through the cleaning lady.
Yeah, because this is my podcast, this is a judgment-free zone, Joe. So I read in bed on my phone at night, but I do two things. One, I turn like the warm light on, the blue light off. I think that's what it's called, like that function. And then the second thing is I put it in focus mode, because before that, when I would try to read on my Kindle app and I would get notifications, like, I couldn't help myself. I would click on the notification to see what it was. And so now I've gotten a lot better about it, because I don't get that ping that pulls me away from the task at hand.
Everybody's got their own little, you know, ways of managing it. I go back to whether that rule that I was pretty emphatic about is, it's just what are people doing to manage the pervasiveness of accessibility and technology in their lives and information, and how they mitigate it, and where are the boundaries? Because if there aren't any boundaries, then there's no way of, I'm not managing it. It's now, it tells me what to do. Like, a notification is a simple but very, very destructive thing. Research goes on and on about when you lose attention, how long it takes to regain it. Think about, like, people that listen to your podcast. You're in the middle of a conversation, having a lovely dinner with somebody, and your phone goes off. There's this moment of truth where you look down at the phone and that person's like, thinks what thought at that moment? You don't really care about me. This conversation's not that important. Whatever, whoever's calling, it stops the conversation. Now, when that happens to me now, what I'll do, generally speaking, is if the circumstances would be that might be something, I'll ask the person permission, like, would you mind if I check this right now? Versus just instinctively doing it. Or I simply just turn it off. Like before the conversation, I just brick it. I'll have a conversation because at the end of the day, probably speaking, this is all like actuarial science. If I waited an hour and a half, nothing bad's going to happen.
And sometimes if something bad did happen, it would solve itself before you got involved with it.
Probably. But we live like we're all 911 operators. So it's like we're not 911 operators. We're not emergency responders. Unless you are, you're not. And just because you're a parent doesn't mean everything's emergency, because what we define as an emergency, a lot of the stuff back in the day waited. And I call this the illusion of immediacy. We live in this illusion. It's an illusion. It's made up in our heads that everything's a burning platform. No, it's not. It's not. Things can and should wait, including going to voicemail.
I love that. I really want to get in a few minutes transition to the scary part of the stuff you're talking about, which is quiet. But I had a podcast guest on a couple episodes ago, Juliet Funt. Her dad was the guy that...
Alan Funt?
Yeah. Alan Funt, Candid Camera.
Candid Camera? Oh, my God. I was a huge fan of that.
Yeah. So Juliet, she has written a book called A Minute to Think. And one of the things she talks about is how we have same concept as you, hallucinated urgency. And one of her tips is instead of texting people you work with after hours, because this thing popped in your head and you feel like you just got to like... shoot it to somebody right away. She's like, put it in your notes section of your phone. And then next time you see that person or that, you know, at the start of the day, the next day, or at the meeting, you see that person during the actual work day, then you bring that up. And so when she told me that, it's kind of stuck with me. So I've tried to do that. But before that, like it could be 10:30 at night and I get an idea in my head, I would shoot a text to somebody because there was like that hallucinated urgency.
Yeah, I mean, this is just an example of self-discipline. You talk about performance and people wanting to perform. People that practice self-discipline don't say yes to everything at the same time. I mean, if you look at eating this way, they would never be fit. If they said yes every time they had an urge, that's just another urge. Treated like as such, you could say no to it. But the thing that I found in this whole process of writing this book was how much of an effect it had on me, how much of an effect it had on families and people and professionals where they just kind of like give into it. And they have no strategies to manage it. But what I found was the most powerful and scary, I love that term that you said, scary, is quiet.
Yeah.
Because what I was writing chapter 14 of the book Noise, and as a writer, we were talking about this briefly before we got on, I'm kind of a reluctant author. So I wrote the books that I wrote because the people that I work with sort of demanded it. Right. So they're looking for help and guidance. So that I wrote a 220-page book on brevity, which was insane. And then I wrote kind of a sequel to that called Noise. And when I was writing chapter 14, I'm like, this is the most hypocritical thing I've ever written because I didn't do it myself. I'm telling the reader to do something that I didn't. So I started on this path of like, okay, well, what does quiet look like for me? It was brutal. Like, I'm like, I don't practice this. I did research on mindfulness and meditation, you name it. Nothing against any of those things. They felt overly technical to me. Like, I was like, wait, I'm doing 10 minutes of quiet. And it felt like it was brutal. It was so difficult. And then I read a quote that sort of in my journey changed my perspective on quiet, on time spent in quiet. The quote is from G.K. Chesterton. It says, anything that's worth doing in life is worth doing badly. And I read that quote and I just started internalizing. I'm like, if it's really worth doing, I could be terrible at it and it's okay.
Yeah.
I was giving myself a grade and I'm like, this is not about giving a grade. I'm not getting an A or B or, D, you know, I'm not getting a letter grade or number grade at all. This is for me to manage noise, and I can be bad at it and it doesn't matter. The second takeaway insight that I had was after reading that quote was it's not a technique. It's an appointment like any other appointment, and it's an appointment worth making and it's an appointment not worth missing. And what happens is people make it as kind of like someday I'll have quiet and peace in my life to think about stuff. It's like, no, it's what makes us human. It's the time we think about things. And if we don't have any time because I'm spending all my day consuming noise, well, guess what? I don't think about it at all. And then I kept on going on this path, and I started setting this appointment. And I was terrible at it, Joe. I was terrible. And I still am to a great extent. But it's not about mastery. It's about doing it. So I started setting, and it changed my brain. It allowed me to start thinking about things and considering things and reading to something that you talked to me, encouraging me about. I started reading again. Whoa. And I started planning, and I started doing these things that were absent in my day because I didn't have the appointment on my calendar for quiet. You can't read when it's noisy. You got to set yourself. You got places and times to do it. And you espouse it. So I started doing that. It changed me as a person. And then one day, about a year and a half ago, I wrote an essay in Quiet called "The Quiet Workplace." And it was a vision around what would work look like if quiet were part of the day, not just in the morning and the evening, but like actually during the work day, because we live in a world of collaboration where it's all about talking and not at all about thinking. And one guy said it to me once. He goes, "I don't think at work." And I'm like, what? He goes, "I talk and do stuff, but I don't think. I think at home." Well, there's noise at home, so he doesn't think at all. So I introduced a program called Quiet Works, and it's around making silence an integral part of work. And I want to share this quote because it's really interesting. One of my colleagues, we share this with our clients, and one of our clients is MasterCard. And this guy who is in charge of innovation, he was talking to my colleague about quiet. And he said to my colleague, "My team's answers aren't good enough." You know, think about it. If your boss said to you, your answers aren't good enough. And he said it wasn't because they weren't smart enough. He says because they're not thinking about it enough. That's quiet's role. We've got to be thinking more and consuming noise less. And that's what led me to the value of quiet. And it stopped being uncomfortable when I stopped giving myself a grade.
I remember when you were talking to me about the concept of quiet works. You were drawing this out on a beer napkin, which is, I think, everything that I've started from our conversations all began on a beer napkin with beer.
It's a good place to start and a good place to end.
Yeah. But this continuum between action and quiet thinking, and we spend so much time on one end of the spectrum that we're not making the best decisions. We're not always being the most effective and efficient.
Well, the picture I drew for you is like a quadrant. It's like an XY quadrant. And you know, the vertical part of that is thoughtful. And then the horizontal is useful or productive. So if you think of the bottom left corner of that, it's something which is thought work that's thoughtless and useless. I'm not making fun of the post office, but I'm making fun of the post office. It's just kind of like delivering junk mail. It's useless and busy, but it doesn't really do anything for anybody because everybody just throws it away. Then if you look at down the right, you can have something which is thoughtless but very productive. I'm working in a place where it's very effective, but they don't ask for my opinion. Then you think about academia. Academia is highly thoughtful, but it's not that productive. I mean, they're writing white papers that nobody reads, but it's really thoughtful stuff. The quiet workplace is something which is really, really thoughtful and really, really productive. I'm thinking and doing things that matter. And there's all this research that talks about that's where engagement and employees are happiest, doing work that matters versus stuff that's thoughtless and useless. That starts to get at the power of if you don't manage noise, you end up working in an environment where it's a blur. So what you described as earlier is a blur. There's no flow. It's a blur. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't remember any of it. It's just information.
I remember it was probably 6-7 years ago. I was in I was at a place and they were kind of on this whole Silicon Valley collaboration kick. And so it was putting everybody in the room, no dividers, everybody's in this bullpen working. I just remember being there and I can't think. we were talking about cell phone noise, but then there was literal noise. There was conversations going on, people just rushing from meeting to meeting to meeting. And so there was no thoughtful action actually taking place.
So a couple of things when I came up with this, when I started thinking about a program, and the website is quiet-works.com or thequietworkplace.com. One of the things I started thinking a lot about was the evolution of work fundamentally. And if you think about collaboration and open spaces, it's all about collaboration and talking. We teach, because based on the book Brief, how to be lean communicators, clear and concise. So make those matters, those moments of collaboration, really quality. Well, when you look at environments, business environments, it's all collaboration. It's all talking all the time. And there's nowhere for people to go for quiet at work. There's not a time for it and there's not a place for it because the entire thing has been designed to do only one type of work, which is collaboration. there's another type of work called thinking, and it's actually what Cal Newport talks about, deep work, like, is a place to go to actually think about things. And if you're right in the middle of collaboration, it's difficult, if not impossible, to think clearly.
For me, like, I'm very busy. My schedule sometimes gets away from me. What are some things that I could do as a leader to find that elusive, scary quiet that we're talking about?
It's elusive, and when you do it, it becomes less scary. I think one of the things to do is to designate a place that you do it. So if you're in an office where people find you, can you go to a place that they couldn't find you? And only a few people could find you if it were an emergency that they did. So is there an office that nobody uses or a conference room that's sort of not in use? And if you went there and somebody were to find you, could you put a sign on the thing that says do not disturb, quiet professional at work, like give some indication. Some people put headphones on as an indicator, like I'm doing thinking, and telling people around you, I'm doing some quiet time right now in the conference room down the hallway. Don't interrupt me. I'll be there for a half hour. Is a place and a time, and then telling people, giving people an indication. Those are a few ways. Another one is resisting the temptation to give into distractions. Like you want, if you're sitting at your desk, my line is you can't close the door if you don't have one. So if you're in an open place where if you're sitting at your desk, you know, put your head down, and I call it like, you know, heart up, head down. So my heart is really in my work, but my head's down, and I'm not going to look up for any reason until I finish what I'm doing. If I'm writing something or I'm reading something or preparing something, I'm not going to put my head on a swivel and start looking around me. Because if I start doing that, I get a visual distraction. But that's another way. It's just head down, keep your head down. Those are a couple of practical strategies, but not trying to like perfect it. It's try to improve it. That's the difference. It's not about being perfect at it. Remember, it's like anything that's worth doing is worth doing badly. Start somewhere. And I think scheduling time and a place is a good place to start.
Well, speaking of starting somewhere, one of the things that you've talked about, you got to tell the story about when you started with your team, when you were getting the Quiet Works off the ground, the 1 minute challenge.
You ask people to do 1 minute of quiet. They're like, that's so easy. Do it before a conference call. Do it before you open a letter. Do it before you turn your car on. And time it for 1 minute where you give yourself 1 minute of quiet before you do something or right after you do something for a minute. And you'll start to feel the duration of time change. And we did this exercise with our team, and they're like, oh, it's easy. I'm like, okay, do that 7 times in a day. So I've got 7 things I do every day. One thing is, you know, pick 7 things, check my email. I'm going to wait a minute before I check my email. Self-discipline. I get a notification. I'm going to wait a minute before I open it. I'm going to hit send on an email. I'm going to wait 1 minute. Just do that for a minute, and you'll start to realize the level of control that you can put into a day to slow it down. Super powerful. I bought these little egg timers. To like 1 minute egg timers. And I gave them to the people who said it was easy. I'm like, all right, do that 7 times out of the day. And it started getting difficult, but it's super powerful.
And I guess like in the process, you're retraining your brain, right?
100%. I mean, if you think about it, it really is around performance, self-discipline, mastery is I have to have more of a voice in what I'm paying attention to and what I'm not paying attention to. When I'm doing something, when I'm not doing something. Because we live in this age where everything is possible at every moment, at every instant of every hour of the day. And the truth is, it's an illusion. So stop living in the illusion. And noise sort of tells me what to do. It's like, no, I don't listen to that. Like, if that's not right important, I'm not going to just stop what I'm doing and just like go a different direction. Like, no, I finished my thought.
Yeah. Yeah. And getting back to some of the stuff that we talk about it from the Green Notebook, you know, reading, writing, reflection. I think what I've learned over the last two and a half years is that one of the hardest things to do is to know thyself. And it's not going to happen if you're constantly distracted, if you're constantly giving into the noise. It actually begins with those quiet minutes that are really hard that you're talking about, Joe.
What you talk about, reading, writing, and reflecting is essential to being human and to perform at a high level professionally. If your listeners don't do what you're telling them, which is great advice, they're going to miss out on being the best version of themselves and missing out big chunks of their lives. The whole thing about reading, you're feeding your mind about things. Then you have a journal and you write in this notebook about what you're reading and you think about it. And then you start having a conversation with yourself. How is this going to affect me? What is it saying to me? this is what people who play at a high level do. They all do it. And your listeners want it. That's why they listen to your podcast. So I would just, you know, I'm going to play that back to you. Is for anybody listening to this podcast, is follow that advice. Read more, write more, and reflect more. And that will, in my world, lower the noise. It'll bring clarity, a lot of clarity that might be missing right now.
All right, we're going to go ahead and end it there, Joe. I'm going to go ahead and frame that. We're going to put it at the start of every podcast. No, I appreciate it. Joe, this is I'm watching your time because I know that you're extremely busy. What are resources that listeners, if they want to learn more about this, where can they go?
Okay, here's the best place to go. If you go to quiet-works.com or thequietworkplace.com, it'll send you to the same destination. There's a couple things. We have a quiet quiz. It takes like 3 to 5 minutes. It's an assessment of how noisy your world is. Take it. It gives you a breakdown in categories of sort of how, where you are you on the scale of how bad it might be. It's a quiet quiz. There's a couple of videos on the site that are just right there on the landing page that talk about like this essay that I wrote called The Quiet Workplace and some basically practices and principles that people should follow to see if you're actually managing in any way. And then finally, it's just the book. I mean, noise is that it's an easy to read book, but it gets into like practical, simple things that I can do that we can do every day to mitigate it, the impact of noise.
And I got one more I'm going to add to that. If you're out there looking for a podcast and like you have a short commute or you're not looking to listen to something as long as this one, you know, where episodes are like 30 minutes an hour, Joe's podcast episodes are typically what, like 12 to 15 minutes each?
12 to 15 minutes, exactly. They're real short.
And so they're highly informative. And Joe discusses the concepts from brief, from noise. It's really insightful. And you can take a lot of this stuff, you know, that you listen to on a quick commute in the morning and just start incorporating it into your day. So I gotta plug your podcast, Joe.
I appreciate you saying that.
Joe, thanks so much for the time. This is awesome. Every time Joe and I get an opportunity to talk, I usually walk away energized, but this is the first time I'm not walking away with a brand new product that I'm about to launch. So this is a first for
we
us.
We stole the napkin, so you have nothing to write on. Joe, thanks so much for having me.
All right, Joe, this was great. Thanks again. Thank you again for listening to another episode of From the Green Notebook Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please give us 5 stars wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps us gain visibility and the opportunity to help more people on their leadership journey. Also, make sure you check out our website at www.fromthegreennotebook.com. There, you can listen to past episodes, read leadership articles written by military leaders from around the world. You can sign up for our monthly reading list email where you can learn about new books that are coming out, and our Sunday reflection email that comes out every Sunday morning. Is really short. It's a 2-minute read, but I guarantee you it's going to start your week off on the right foot. Finally, make sure you follow us on Twitter at FTGNNotebook, and you can find us on Instagram and Facebook by searching for From the Green Notebook. Again, thank you so much for coming on this journey with us. I am humbled by the opportunity to learn these lessons alongside you. So please join us next week for another episode of From the Green Notebook, where we're going to help you lead with the best version of yourself. I came from the mud.